Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, as John Denver sings in his famous song, Leaving on a Jet Plane, your bags are packed and you're ready to go.
Yes, we are talking just the hours before I will be on the Prime Minister's flight to Washington, D.C., before his first meeting with Joe Biden in the White House on Thursday.
So this is a big trip for Bennett because, on the one hand, it's his real first foray into foreign affairs. He's going to have a big high-profile meeting with the president, Secretary of State Blinken, the defense secretary, and others, but also because it's going to be looked at very much in comparison to how the prior person who had held his role, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was a regular visitor to the White House in recent years. You've covered Netanyahu's trips. Now you'll be covering Bennett's first trip. I'm assuming you'll be doing a lot of comparing between the two.
Yeah, and so far, it doesn't seem that different, to be honest. Bennett's prime focus is Iran and the Iranian threat. And he, you know, his advisors and he himself have told us basically that his message to Biden is that at this point, there is no reason to rejoin the 2015 Iran deal, that Iran is so advanced in its nuclear program now that the deal isn't actually going to contain them, and it's only going to lift sanctions and give them benefits without really much restrictions. So, I mean, substantively, I don't think that's so different from Netanyahu coming and saying, you know, the Iran deal is bad, I don't want to talk about it.
But some of the maybe more superficial elements of the trip are a little different. You had mentioned that Gilad Bennett, the prime minister's wife, will not be joining him on this trip. We know that Netanyahu never left the country without Sarah next to him at his side. Bennett will not be staying at the Blair House, which is the residence across from the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue, where the president usually hosts visiting dignitaries, which might mean that there's no big laundry operations that are going to be taking place. We've seen reports most recently in the Washington Post about how when Netanyahu spent some time at the Blair House, they would bring suitcases full of clothes to get laundered while there. So there's some differences already.
Yeah, I mean, definitely on that level, certainly on the gossipy level, Gilad Bennett not coming is very different. Bennett, his office says it's because they're taking the coronavirus restrictions very seriously. I would imagine it's also because it is the end of August and there's no schools and most camps are finished too. And they have, I think, four kids who are going to be at home with nothing going on. So I'm going to guess that plays a part as well. But yeah, so with the COVID restrictions, we are all going to be staying at the same hotel as the prime minister, which is a hotel that's close to the White House instead of the Blair House. And Netanyahu loved the Blair House. It was like a big deal for him. It was important for him to be given like the honor of staying in the Blair House. So the reason Ben is not staying in the Blair House is not because they don't want to honor him, but because it is under renovation.
So we're obviously talking before the trip. You'll be there with him for a few days in Washington. The meeting, the high-profile meeting with Biden, will be taking place Thursday, late in the day, Israel time. So we don't yet know how that's all going to go. But let's assume that everything goes off without a hitch. The trip goes smoothly. The meetings go well. There's a good rapport, good relationship that's created between these two. What does that mean for Bennett politically back in Israel, right? Because let's always keep in mind is that he doesn't have a political base anymore, right? He's lost his voters. So what does that mean for him if he gets a good trip out of this?
You know, it's hard to say. I think the right, there will be those like Netanyahu who will try to turn it into, oh, well, the reason this went off without a hitch is because Bennett agreed to do everything Biden wants, and, you know, he's just giving up and giving in, and he's a leftist, etc. I think if it goes well enough, and there's some sort of tangible positive result of all this, or that it goes off well enough that some of the very right-wing journalists that are going to be on the trip write positive things about the trip, then maybe some people on the more moderate right will be convinced. You know, I think at the moment, a lot of people are sort of angry at Bennett. They feel like he lied about who his coalition partners would be and that he's teaming up with the left. But I think in the end, the test is going to be in the end result, right? Whenever the next election is, people will look at what he actually did and less at, you know, what he said his coalition negotiations will be. So it could be another thing to sort of win over the moderate right. The far right, I think he's finished with.
Right. No, and I also, I mean, you're not going to see real clear results or what comes out being the significant or outcome of these meetings right away. It's not immediate, right? We don't automatically know also what new understandings they've reached, whether it's on Iran or on the Palestinian front. But I think that just having a meeting that shows that someone else in the prime minister's seat can get along with the U.S. president, that symbolism also has significance here in Israel, because Israelis have gotten so used to thinking that there's only one person who can actually hold those meetings and only one person who can actually sit in that Oval Office next to a president with that fireplace and, what is it, usually the portrait of George Washington or something like that behind them. But you know, Lahav, we also saw this week is the situation in Gaza is heating up, and that's never a surprise. There's always tension and escalations along the border between Israel and Hamas. And this is despite the fact that there was supposedly this new mechanism with Qatar that would transfer money and it would get Hamas to keep the calm. We saw that rally on Saturday along the border, and then a guy tucking a gun, shooting it through a hole, like this hole in the wall, and critically injuring a soldier, Barel Shmueli. We then heard Bennett's phone call, right, with the father of Barel, Yossi, and the prime minister got the names wrong, wasn't clear on the details, which hospital Barel was being treated at, whether he had undergone surgeries. To me, it felt like the whole country knew. He was in Soroka and Beersheba, and he had undergone a few surgeries throughout the night. Now, obviously, the prime minister has a lot on his plate, but it also could be just not the right preparation for that call. It's just not having the details in front of him. Is your sense, if I compare this for a second to the trip to Washington, is he doing a lot of homework? Is he preparing? Is he working on his statements? Is that how he's going into this visit?
Yes and no. Yes, when it comes to Iran, Bennett ordered this huge policy review, extremely in-depth, from all different parts of government to give them his opinion, his assessment, and he's showing up to Biden with a report. Different contingencies, you know, a return to the Iran deal, no return to the Iran deal, and what can be done to protect Israel and the region and the world from the Iranian threat. In that sense, he's very, very prepared. I say no, though, because Bennett, and I think this is something he has in common with Biden, is a person who likes to go off book. He has kind of like a warm personality, he likes to be friendly with people, and he's not someone who likes to read a script. And so, you know, you never know what to expect with someone like that. And again, as I said, I think that Biden is that kind of person, too. So there's always a chance for something very interesting to happen.
Interesting. In a shift turn to another topic for a moment, Mirav Mikhaeli, I wanted to get your sense of this whole situation. I know how I feel about it. So Friday night, both of us were not watching the news because we observed the Shabbat, so we didn't see the massive onslaught against her for traveling on a private visit to the United States. It was supposedly reported as a private vacation with her partner, this known satirist comedian Lior Schlein. Mirav Mikhaeli is obviously the head of labor and the transportation minister, and people were attacking her. How can you fly during a spike in COVID infections, leaving the country, going to the United States, especially someone from the transportation ministry should not be doing that. Fast forward to Saturday night. She puts up a post on Facebook. Her and her partner, Lior, are holding a baby. And they just announced they had had this child through a surrogate mother in the United States, and they had traveled to the U.S. to be there for the birth and, I guess, to bring the baby back to Israel. Baby's name is Uri. I felt that there were two things about this story. I'm curious to get your input. Number one is, why do we care that she went overseas, right? The airport's open. Israelis are allowed to travel. Let someone have a private life, right? There's a right to privacy. Not everything that every minister does needs to make its way into the media, number one. Number two is my feeling is, why are we demonizing people who travel, right? Now, maybe I'm biased. I also like to travel. But if you're allowed to travel, you're not breaking the rules. You're not violating. The government has decided on these rules. let people do what they want. I mean, what's behind this?
There are a few things. I think Herb Kanan, our senior analyst, I thought wrote a really good analysis about this, about how Israelis still like to, even though we are not like the socialist country we once were, Israelis still like look at people who are like, quote unquote, showing off very badly, you know, and they want our ministers and our government to be more modest than the average person. Netanyahu, well, I guess love him or hate him, but some people hate him for that and some people forgive him for that anyway. But so I think there's a little bit of that, like, oh, who does she think she is? You know, I also think that, listen, that it's true. You have a right to travel. But if the government is discouraging people from travel, then I think it is hypocritical for people to travel. Although obviously she had a good reason in the end. But if she was just going on vacation, you know, I don't know, to Niagara Falls, then that would be ridiculous, right? Like, it's the exact opposite of what the government's telling you to do. Now, I have a lot to say about this on the level of just who Mayrav Mikhaeli is and what just happened in her life. Because Mayrav Mikhaeli is, I would say, the most, even before entering politics, was the most famous feminist in Israel. Now, I personally am of the belief that you can be a feminist and have children, but she, for decades, and she's 54 years old, she for decades has talked about the family structure being oppressive to women and that the expectation that women have children is oppressive to women. And she talked about it a lot. And she also has talked about how she thinks there needs to be alternatives to the traditional family culture structure, that you could have three parents, that you could have four parents, all kinds of very sort of radical
I'll just interject. There's a, if you're interested, there's a good TED video you can watch of also her talking about how marriage is oppressive and is a terrible institution and needs to be dismantled.
Right. Well, and she's not married, so at least there's that. And the TED Talk is in English. It's interesting because in election campaigns, I always wondered sort of why more people didn't bring that up as like, quote unquote, dirt against her, you know, because it just seems like something that most Israelis wouldn't like. But it did not come up as an election issue, as far as I know. And, you know, I am not advising people how to sling mud at their opponents. So I kept that to myself mostly. But you know, I found it interesting. And she wrote a Facebook post about it. She wrote that for years now, Leo Schlein, her comedian partner, has wanted children and that she hasn't changed her opinion about having children be oppressive to women. So I just wonder if, like, Leo Schlein is going to be, like, the primary parent. I mean, she's certainly very busy. And he is too, I guess, but maybe being a comedian is a little bit more of a flexible job. So I just find it very interesting. I think, you know, I've known her since she's entered politics, and leaving aside politics and opinions and things like that, she's a really warm and caring person. Even though she comes off very tough, I think she's a very, warm, and I just wish her, you know, congratulations, and I'm sure she'll be a great mom.
Well, on the topic of parenthood and children, we're going to talk a bit later with David Klar, a friend of mine who is the principal of Studio Ankori, a high school in Jaffa, just near Tel Aviv, about the challenges that a principal faces in the opening of a new school year, still under the shadow of COVID, what the kids are going through, and those challenges. But we have the new school year. Lahav, you're getting back just before Shabbat, I think late Friday. The school year begins Tuesday, right? We decided in this country that everyone's going to school. I'm sorry, on Wednesday, on September 1st.
Wednesday. Yeah.
You'll be ready? The kids are going to be ready for that?
Yeah, but I mean, my kids are in preschool. My son is so young that he's even in, you know, there isn't even public school yet. So it's completely different. You know, older kids have a lot more to be nervous about, I think.
We have to do COVID tests for our kids. We're going to take them, I think, Thursday to do the serological test to see if possibly they have antibodies, although I'm skeptical and I don't think they would have them. Lots of testing, lots of there's anxiety, I think, but more is my wife, Chaya, told me the other day. And when I said, you know, going to school and this, she started laughing. She said, Yaakov, they're going to be in school for a couple of days, then they're going to be home for a few weeks. So I don't know who's going to be right, But we will see.
Yeah, well, for a few weeks because of the holidays. So, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur Sukkot. It's the whole month is just shot.
The whole month is shot. I hope it's just because of the holidays and it's not because anyone needs to go into quarantine. But Lahav, you go back to packing, getting ready for the trip. We wish you lots of luck. We'll see you back here in Israel. Good luck to all the kids who are starting school next week. And the on this today's show, we have an interview that I did with Michael Oren, Israel's former ambassador to the United States, ahead of Naftali Bennett's trip to meet with Biden. And later in the show, a interview and conversation Lahav and I did with David Klar. We're pleased to have with us Michael Oren, Israel's former ambassador to the United States, a best-selling author, a historian, lecturer, and also the president of an NGO called Israel 2048, which we'll talk about a little later. But Michael, oh, and I forgot to mention also, rumored to be a candidate for the head of the Jewish Agency. I don't know if you'll want to talk about that, but maybe we'll try to get you to say something. But I first want to talk, you know, Prime Minister Bennett is going for his first visit to Washington. He'll be entering the Oval Office for the first time, I think probably for the first time in his life, right? He wasn't there in any other capacity in the past. You know, walk us through what's that like for a first meeting between a prime minister and a president? You were in a lot of those Oval Office meetings between presidents and prime ministers. What is that like in that first setting?
Well, first of all, good to be with you, Yaakov. Thank you. Well, first of all, it's the protocol and ceremonial part of it. The Marine Guard at the front, and you come in and you sign the guest book, and you fight over, you know, which member of your aides are going to get the pen. And then you have what's called, you know, a 1+8 or a 1+6, which is the principal plus 6 or 8 people who come in with him. It's usually a national security advisor, several political advisors, ministers if they're with him. And the president's entourage will include the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, some other experts. And you'll have a group meeting. If it's a luncheon, you'll have lunch. But then the crucial part comes. It's the one-on-one. And then the president and the prime minister will adjourn to the Oval Office. The lunch is usually held in the Roosevelt Room. And in the Oval Office, usually they will schedule about an hour for that meeting. It will probably run 2 hours, which is usually a good sign. And then they'll come out smiling, and then they'll have they'll invite the press into the Oval Office, have questions and answers. They'll make statements, and then there'll be photographic, you know, photo ops. That I would assume that would be the standard procedure for this prime minister's visit. You might remember, under the visit, in several times during the visit of the previous prime minister, he was not let into the front entrance, but to the back exit without a photograph, without a meal. There were some interesting exchanges in the Oval Office, including some lectures, but maybe we don't go there. This visit will go off, I think, without a hitch.
Right. So, you know, just comparing it to the past, it seems that all sides, whether it's Bennett in Jerusalem or Biden in Washington, have an interest in this being good, right? This going well, warm, fuzzy, everybody feeling good at the end of it. But I'm curious from your perspective, with the backdrop now of this, the scenes we're still seeing daily in Kabul and what happened in Afghanistan, how much is that going to be a shadow over the Biden-Bennett meeting on Thursday?
Well, the meeting will be influenced by something that did happen and something that didn't happen. Okay, what did happen, of course, is Afghanistan. And the United States is going to want to show its diplomatic mettle. It wants to reassure its allies to the world, who are very shaky right now. And no better way to say that, to show that than through an expression of solidarity and unity with its ultimate ally, the State of Israel. So certainly that will be there. What hasn't happened is the Iran nuclear deal and the renewal of that deal, which would have cast a very different shadow on this meeting. And so part of the discussion will invariably be, okay, how does the United States shore up Israel's security in light of what's happened in Afghanistan, the victory to radical Sunni Islam, the proliferation of American arms that have been captured by the Taliban. And we're talking about vast numbers of arms and a very high sophistication that will proliferate throughout the region very shortly, very swiftly, and show up in our backyard, certainly in Gaza first. So how is the United States going to help Israel address that threat? And on the Iranian issue, there'll be a discussion, hopefully an intimate discussion between the prime minister and the president about how the United States will reinforce Israel's security if the deal is renewed. But also, if it isn't renewed and Iran continues to enrich uranium at dangerously high levels, how will the United States ensure or reinforce Israel's security in that situation as well? So there's certainly a lot to talk about. And of course, there'll be the peace process.
You know President Biden well from your term as ambassador. You were there 4 years, exactly during his first 4 years in office as the vice president. So you know a lot, you know him, you know the people that are surrounding him and are advising him. How aware are they of the limited wiggle room that Prime Minister Bennett has when it comes to the Palestinian issue? Or are they going to be driven by ideology and they're just going to hammer away two-state solution, freeze on settlement construction, whatever it might be, to try to get their point across?
Well, it will certainly sound tautological for me to say that Biden and his staff is not Trump and his staff, but neither is Biden and his staff Barack Obama and his staff. They're very different. Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, all of whom I know very well. Joe Biden was my principal point of contact during the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton, it's not well known, actually boycotted the Israeli embassy during much of my time in Washington. So my major contact with the administration was Joe Biden, and I was with him for many hours. Is that all of these individuals, and above all the president himself, are deeply committed to Israel, deeply committed to the U.S.-Israel alliance. Yes, they are also committed to the Iran nuclear deal. Yes, they are committed to the two-state solution. But even those issues are not deeply held ideological issues. They are policy issues. They are certainly a reflection of where the Democratic Party and its progressive wing want the administration to be on those issues. And of course, you know, these are political people. It will not be the same. In effect, you know, Israel just announced it was going to build 2,000 units in Judea and Samaria. That would have created a major conflagration in our relationship with the Obama administration, a total crisis, and it barely passed with a blimp during the Biden people, especially since Israel offset it by announcing 1,000 permits for Palestinian construction in Area C, which has previously been almost off limits for Palestinian.
Right.
So it's going to be different. It's not a deeply ideological or ideologically held positions. And that does, endow the situation with a lot of wiggle room from the president and his staff. They will, however, and if I may, Yaakov, just sort of wax on about this a second more, they will ask Bennett to help them help him. We can help you on security issues, but help us by making some gestures to the Palestinians and enable us to say to our own progressive wing, look what we're doing for the Palestinians.
I hear that. But the question is how much Bennett can do and how much he can deliver on that. I would guess if it's economic initiatives, you know, easing restrictions at crossings or industrial zones and the likes, that's something that Bennett would be able to do politically. You sat in a coalition with him in the past, right, when you were in the Kulanu party. What do you think that, you know, now putting on your political hat with your ambassadorial hat, do you think that he'd be able to maybe give them that thing that could help them help him?
Yeah, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was in a meeting with Naftali Bennett, opposed a Trump proposal to build a certain number of Palestinian houses in a 50-meter straight strip around the city, the Palestinian city of Qalqilya. And Bennett basically killed the proposal by opposing it. All right, that was on a 50-meter strip. It's a different Naftali Bennett today. You know, when you're sitting in the pilot seat, you see things quite differently. He's now the prime minister. He's a prime minister of a very wide spectrum of parties in his coalition. And he has to deal with the president of the United States. So I think he's going to show greater flexibility to the maximum degree. I mean, I think the people who are going to vote for Bennett because he is right wing have already moved over to the Smotrich types, who are far more to the right. And Naftali Bennett has cast his fate to the centrist wing, which I personally think is a very smart political move.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. So I want to move with you just to zoom in on the Iran deal, right? So we know that the deal seems to be dead for the time being. The Iranians have walked away. The Americans have made offer after offer of removing sanctions, but that's not enough to get the Iranians to agree to a return to the JCPOA. And the Americans have also put some of their demands on the table. What do you think that Israel can realistically be asking for in this meeting? Because this meeting is said to be crucial for Bennett, at least in trying to convince the president of Israel's security concerns here.
They'll be talking about capabilities and understandings. So clearly, the United States has vastly greater military capabilities than we have. We'd like to have some of them. We'd like the Iranians to know that we have some of them, but also understandings. To put it quite simply, Yaakov, you know, what will be America's position if Iran breaks out to create a nuclear weapon? Israel has to act. What will the United States do? Will the United States stand by us logistically, strategically, diplomatically, legally? There are many, many understandings that can be forged at this point, particularly if they're done quietly and if they're done in an atmosphere of mutual trust.
Interesting. So we have a new ambassador who's going to be heading now to Washington, Michael Herzog, who is the brother of the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog, a well-known defense expert, knows the ins and outs of the Iran deal, as well as all negotiations with the Palestinians over the last quarter of a century. When thinking, I'm sure you know Mike well, and thinking about what his challenges are going to be, you know, you have a perspective from your time in Washington, definitely to where we are today, with the relationship specifically with the Democratic Party and the liberal flank, I'd say, of the Jewish community in the United States. How much do you think he'll have to invest in trying to repair those relations, which we know have been frayed in recent years?
Well, first of all, Mike is a close friend, and I was delighted by his appointment. I think it's an excellent choice. And he's precisely the man for the job now, because what we need is a person who's very experienced in quiet diplomacy. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, the question of how to proceed on the Iranian issue, how to deal with the aftermath of Afghanistan, the fallout from it, is all going to be a matter of quiet diplomacy, and Mike is the right man. He's going to have his hands full, having said that, with trying to restore bipartisan support for Israel. And I'm still of the school that believes that bipartisan support is a strategic national interest for this country. He's going to have to reach out to those Democrats to whom you could reach out. You can't reach out, you know, to those Democrats who deny us the right to exist and want to cut off all aid. I think that they're probably beyond the pale. But there's no shortage of Democrats who feel that they've been neglected by Israel in previous years, who are still reeling over the prime minister's speech before the joint session in 2015. It's important to point out that I opposed that speech. I didn't think it was the best idea for precisely that reason. And sort of to begin the process of repairing it to the degree that today it can be repaired.
And what are the ways that you would go about doing that? Right? Beyond engagement, beyond talking, what more can be done, really?
Well, I think it begins with the Prime Minister Bennett's visit. I understand it's a lightning visit, but if he has 45 spare minutes, Yaakov, spend it on the Hill. Spend it with some of the progressives who actually are standing with us, like Representative Torres from New York. Reach out. Make that effort. Invite them to Israel. Make time for them when they come here. All of that should be done, all the while explaining to the best we can that Israel, in so many ways, is a progressive country, that the Palestinian issue is a very complex issue, that we legitimately see the Iran nuclear deal as differently than the United States. We are in Iran's backyard. We are threatened with national annihilation by the Iranians. The United States is not, at least not yet. And you know, legitimately, we have a right and a duty to oppose it. Right. And it's not about opposing President Obama or a slap in the face to the administration. It's about our lives and our children's lives. These cases can be made. Will we persuade everyone? We won't. But I think we'll have a significant level of the success if we make a serious effort.
Michael, I want to ask you, you're the president of the NGO Israel 2048. What you're thinking and planning ahead of Israel's centennial, right? What can you tell us of what does this NGO do? What's its objective?
Well, it began with my time when I was a deputy in the prime minister's office and my time in Knesset. And it began as a national investigation into what Israel should look like on its 100th birthday to ensure a second century of success or even survival, because we're facing no shortage of threats that would maybe cast doubt on that survival, particularly on issues of, say, the Haredi integration into the workforce. The government fell, Corona came, and during the Corona, I wrote a series of essays about Israel's future and defense policy, Jewish world policy, Israel Arabs, health policy, education policy, and it began a series of Zoom talks. And it sort of picked up momentum, Yaakov. Before I knew it, I had a board and a series of sponsors. And the goal is, first of all, to create a collection of these essays in multiple languages, and to send them out not only through Israeli society, but to throughout the diaspora to get us all talking about the future. Nobody here is talking about the future. We're so focused on daily crises and challenges. And to really get young people involved, people who actually inherit this country in the year, 2048. I don't know if my mom going to be around at that point. I'll be quite advanced if I am. And to stimulate these conversations through town hall meetings, parlor meetings, school meetings, pre-army courses, and get us all talking about the kind of state we want and facing some of the hardest issues, very hard issues. One of the issues we're grappling with is polygamy in Israeli society. What that means when, 30% of a certain population has four wives who are purchased. We actually have, in violation of Israeli law, basically chattel slavery for women in this country. How can that be? And the political ramifications of it. So we're dealing with tough issues. And it's been fascinating. And everyone involved in this is a volunteer.
Interesting. Michael, you're also a candidate. We've reported this as well in the Jerusalem Post for the role of chairman of the Jewish Agency. That's going to be coming up, I would say, probably sometime in the next few weeks. There's a board that's meeting. There's a lot going on there. But explain to me why you even would want that role.
First of all, it's the largest Jewish philanthropic organization in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's the organization that brings together the Jews of Israel, not just the Jews, by the way. It also has programs that do outreach to Arab and other minority populations in this country and with the Jewish people worldwide. So it is the central organization and has extraordinary programs in every field, from education, social welfare, youth programs. So you read the list of programs from the Sofnut and you're deeply inspired, but also understand it's a huge, huge challenge. My whole life has been tied up with the Jewish Agency. I came here as an Olé in the 70s, and I was in an absorption center, and I was a lone soldier. Later on, I worked with Jewish refuseniks from the Soviet Union with the Jewish Agency. I came out of the army, and I established in Knesset the forum for lone soldiers, working with the WINGS organization of the Jewish Agency. And most recently, I've served with Buzhi Herzog and with Natan Sharansky on a board that oversees the more than 2,000 shlichim, emissaries, around the world to American campuses and communities around the world. It's an extraordinary program with many, many challenges. Now, all of that aside, the Jewish people are facing a crucial moment. We could lose major shares of the Jewish people unless we take a very proactive approach to reaching out to even Israelis who are living abroad and bringing them back into the fold of the Jewish people, of reestablishing the connection with Israel, explaining and educating Israel much, much better than we do. So the challenges are manifold. And I would be deeply honored to be able to fulfill that role. I think it'd be a fulfillment of a lifetime of preparation for it.
Michael, I can tell firsthand, testify that you've been around the block. I remember the first time I met you, I think, was back on a bus in the Gaza Strip as they were taking us reporters during the disengagement inside Gaza late in the middle of the night. You were wearing a uniform doing your reserve duty in the IDF spokesperson's office back then. So you've made the rounds, that's for sure.
I have made the rounds. And I have the white hair to show it, Doug.
So I got the white hair to show it.
Yeah.
Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, thanks very much for being with the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Pleasure, and I hope it's not premature to say Shana Tova to everybody.
So it's great to have with us David Klar, who is a personal friend, but is also the principal of Studio Ancori, which is a high school of about 230 students from 7th to 12th grade, based in Yafo, just outside of Tel Aviv. It's part of the Ancori School Network, which has about, I think, right, six schools throughout the country, throughout Israel. And David, you are now in the last, I'd say, countdown of about a week and a few days till September 1st, which it seems that the school year is going to begin on time. So we're curious to know, how does a principal like yourself prepare a school for another year of COVID learning when there's just so much uncertainty around?
So hi, good to be here, Yaakov. I think the first thing to say is that, you know, as you know, I just recently moved roles. I moved from one Ankori school in Tel Aviv to the school in Yafo, which is a school for creative thinking and entrepreneurship. And to do that a month before the school year began obviously adds another level to my own personal experience and to the experience of the staff that I'm now working with. Within the context of the uncertainty of the last year and a half, so that personally, that's my additional level that I've had to add to. What I will say is that at Ankori, we very much work together. The principals work together, and we've worked very closely together over the last 18 months to kind of glean from the what's going on out there in the field to see what works best. Within different populations, within different educational setups, what are the different ways that we can best work? Certainly so that the kids are looked after properly, so that the kids are getting the best education possible under the circumstances, and also to make sure the teachers' well-being is also looked after. That's not a small thing. When it comes to teachers, many of whom who have young children at home and are trying to, you know, in a parallel universe, they're trying to get their children connected to their schools and also teach at the same time. So there's a lot of different levels going on there. Very important to us is Ankori. I think we've really come down, we've kind of understood that less is more. Within this framework, not to try and go on the whole gamut of education that we were used to 2 years ago. But when needs be, to reduce the number of subjects that they're studying, to give them more focus, to give more in-depth learning, so that they don't, they don't get lost out there in the world right. in the world of education.
Well, so you're the principal of an art, like of a school that's focused on art. It sounds like you were saying creative thinking.
It's creative thinking that uses the arts in or for the creative thinking process. So we don't teach the kids all study five different artistic subjects, which are music, cinema, drama, art, dance. They mm-hmm. learn the theory behind it. They learn the skills, but they don't learn to become dancers and musicians. The idea is that all the year groups, all the kids, they all study in seasons. So there are three seasons per year, and all the subjects, no matter what it is, maths, English, history, they're all connected to the season subject. So for example, if they're learning about memory, so all the subjects are geared to memory. And at the end of the season, the kids have to come up with one idea that they need to research.
So my question was, when you have a really special, unique program like that, how do you continue that when you have this sort of pared down curriculum for the pandemic?
Right. So I think one of the easier things for us is because everything is connected to one theme per season. At the end of the season, the students have to come up with a research project that's connected to that central theme. So whether or not you've reduced the history or the literature that you teach, at the end of the day, the central theme is still the central theme. So you may be losing a little bit here in material or a little bit here in the subject matter that might be being taught, but essentially the core idea stays the same.
I'm curious though, if, you know, one of the problems that I think a lot of people have seen with Corona, and I have three kids who are going to be going into the school system this year. I had four last year. One graduated, thankfully. But I think that what happened with Corona and a lot of the distance learning and being on screen so much and away from the classroom created issues when it comes to social interaction for some of these children, but also didn't it killed a bit of that creative spark, right? Like, if you need to be in a setting to be creative and to be innovative, is that something that you've seen with school children over the last year and a half is that it's difficult for them to come up to be more creative than they used to be?
Let me start with the, you spoke about the social and emotional well-being. That was the first part of your question. That's something that was very, very clear, very, very quickly, that this was suffering. One of the concepts that we came up with in Onkori was to map the geographical areas where the students were living. And when we were in lockdown, but you were allowed to go, for example, a kilometer from your house, then to actually get the kids together in their geographical areas and to learn together. So although they may not have been in the same class or even not in the same year, at least we were facilitating meeting. And meeting, not just meeting for the sake of meeting, but meeting around some sort of learning activity, which we believe certainly help. So that was one of the things we came up with. But the other thing I'll say is that we're very used to, in the educational system, looking only within the four walls of the classroom, and that's our creative setting, or that's our educational setting. Ironically, I think because we had to take it outside of there, I think the opportunity for creativity was much wider. You know, all of a sudden, the house becomes your creative muse. Or the area in which you live, which perhaps you might not have discovered before then. You know, I'm sure we all discovered those people that were exercising within 200 meters of their house. All of a sudden, you discover areas that you didn't really knew existed beforehand. So all of a sudden, you know, your kitchen, your own kitchen becomes your creative habitat, if you like. Which really hadn't been until before. Your creative habitat had been the four walls of your classroom, your desk and your chair. Your family became a much greater part of your learning. So there were far more many, ironically, there were more people involved whilst we were studying online than there were beforehand. So it really depends what you're willing to look at and what you're willing to consider and whether or not you're willing to look outside the box. For the learning. The other thing I'll say, maybe with regards to the 21st century soft skills that education's been talking about 20 years, you know, which is critical thinking and problem solving and agile thinking, creativity, imagination, empathy, humility, collaboration. All these things have been mentioned recently in a McKinsey report, and actually, I think that schools have been forced to do that over the last 2 years. You know, I think once upon a time, you finished your school year, you pretty much knew what was going to be in the next school year. And you didn't really, you weren't forced to better things, to change things, to adapt things. And I think school principals have been forced to do that for maybe...
Because of Corona.
And I think there are fantastic opportunities. I think there have been fantastic opportunities you know, to improve things, to really move things towards the 21st century. I think one of the concerns of people and principals that have discovered new ways of teaching is actually going back to what there was. So on the one hand, we're very worried about going back to teaching online. But on the other hand, teaching online has actually taught us some things that I think are important to keep. Somehow. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're going to be doing is each of our year groups are going to be studying online one day a month because new things happen, things are updated, new educational materials become available online. And at the end of the day, all of the students that are now learning, they all need to become qualified digital citizens of the world. And they're not going to do that if they're always sitting in class.
Well, it's not only the kids who have to become digital citizens of the world. It's also the older teachers and principals like yourself, no offense, right, who also have to become a little more digital savvy.
No offense taken. 100%. You know, and at the end of the day, if you do the same thing over and over again, you don't develop, not as a person, not as a professional. But when you learn different things each year, as the years go past, your what you do becomes more relevant to what's going on in the world today.
So I want to ask you about a different subject that's come up with the schools. So Education Minister Ifa Chacha-Bitone for much of the summer opposed vaccinations in schools, even though other vaccines are given regularly in schools, whether it's, you know, polio vaccine or HPV or the flu shot. But she didn't want to add the COVID vaccine to that. Now it looks like the government has sort of overruled her and that those vaccines will be happening. Do you think that that is appropriate? Do you think that students who haven't been vaccinated so far will agree to do it now in school?
So it's interesting you bring that up, because that's obviously, you know, as Yaakov asked me before, his first question, how are you gearing up for the next year? And, you know, this year as opposed to last year, the question of vaccinations has come up. And, you know, how does a school approach that? You know, just with the other vaccines, no student is forced to take the vaccine. Obviously, they need parental consent. In order to take those vaccines, which obviously I think is correct. I think here you have a much more sensitive subject out in the open. There's obviously many, many Israelis that don't believe in the vaccine, or they have doubts about the vaccine. And that's their right. You know, that's their democratic right to have that. As difficult or as not difficult that may be personally, on a personal level, that's their democratic right. What I think our role is, you know, and to be honest, I think that at the end of the day, parents that want to vaccinate their children will get their children vaccinated, and whether or not the vaccination stations occur in school. And I can only speak about Tel Aviv, and I live in Jerusalem, so I can only, you know, whether or not there's a station in school, I don't think that's going to change the ball game here. What I think is important as educators is that we provide a safe area for the students to discuss this. There's many layers of the subject. There's fake news. There's what's true and what isn't true. There's social pressure. There's all kinds of nuances here that I think is important to discuss. You know, the students don't live within a vacuum, come to school and take the vaccination. They know what's going on. And I have one kid who's not 12 yet, you know, and he's 4 months away from his 12th birthday, and he's already started to ask us, are you going to make me take the vaccination? I'm not really sure I want to take it, you know, and he's 11. So I think it's important that the subject is raised in the classroom. But I also think it's important that the variety of views is allowed in a safe space, so that no one feels that they are forced to do anything that they don't want to do.
So how do teachers, like, what are you telling teachers that they should say? So if they're asked that question, what are they supposed to answer?
I think they're supposed to allow a proper conversation about that. I think it's the same, you know, in Israel, we have lots of difficult subjects that we have to raise. I think it's important for us to raise the question of the Palestinians is an important question to raise within the classroom in a safe space. There are lots of children that have very varying views on that subject. I think Right. It's the same thing here. I think it's an important part of guiding students through difficult subjects and how to respect others and respect other viewpoints. And you can still be friends with someone who has an opposing view to you. I think that's the role of the teacher. I don't think the role of the teacher is to express an opinion here nor there.
To facilitate a discussion is
correct,
what they're supposed to do.
Correct, absolutely.
That's exactly what we try to do, David, at the newspaper, right? Facilitate a discussion. And sometimes people get upset because they feel like we're pushing one angle as opposed to another angle. But I think that...
Well, that's a lot of controversies about that in Israeli schools in recent years, too, I think.
Right, who you let in the classroom, who you don't let in the classroom, breaking the silence, B'Tselem, organizations like those, right?
Yeah. Correct.
Not easy being a school principal in 2021, David.
it isn't, but on the one hand, you know that you're never going to be, you're certainly, you know, the last 3 years, if you're a principal of a school, I think also if you're a teacher in a school, you're not going to be in the same place at the end of the year that you were at the start of the year. And that, I think, can only be good for education. You know, I'm sure, Yaakov, you've seen and I've read more reports today about the number of positions that are still open 10 days before the start of the school year, not only positions of teachers, but positions of principals. I think that the last 2 years has kind of turned teaching upside down, and maybe people need to rethink whether it's the profession for them. And that's going to mean that the education ministry is going to have to rethink what that means for training of teachers, who they want to attract, how they're going to attract them, what they're going to do with regards to remuneration and teacher salary. You know, everything has changed. It's not the same as it was 2 years ago.
Sure. Well, David, we appreciate you taking out the time to talk to us. I know that you have teacher orientation going on in these days, and we're just a little over a week out of September 1st, so you got a lot of work ahead. And we wish you the best of luck in the new school, the David Klar, principal of Studio Ancori in Yafo. Thank you very much, and Behatzlacha on September 1st.
Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you, Lav.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be back next week.